Melvin Welch is not present at the Centennial Building in St. Paul. The court was just in contact with him by telephone to inquire about his whereabouts. He says he inadvertently scheduled the oral argument for a different day. He is out of town today. The panel's decided to go ahead with oral arguments. We always reserve the right to reschedule, but under the circumstances, we believe that we can go forward and hear oral argument from the appellant and more than likely submit the case based on that argument. So counsel for the state, appellant, you may begin.
Well, thank you, Your Honors. This is Shane Baker, Cadre County Attorney, appearing for the appellant, State of Minnesota. It's the only case I remember where I come into the argument feeling like the issue is already decided in many ways. And that's, of course, given the Casilius opinion. But I thought that oral argument was necessary because of, I guess, one key issue. I wanted to know about that there was an additional issue we raised that the state in Casilius did not raise. And the issue is the effect of the Maurer decision. That is a state Supreme Court decision. It addresses child porn, or sexual imagery. This case also addresses sexual imagery. And more importantly, that decision is directly on point dealing with the issue of what does right or reason to know mean in a First Amendment context. And it wasn't just an offhand thing that the Supreme Court addressed in that decision. They went on for about, I think, 5 pages or so, and they ultimately concluded to adopt the Osborne v. Ohio U.S. Supreme Court standard of recklessness. This is in stark contrast to the Casilius opinion, which recognized reason to know under a negligent standard. And I did see in the Casilius opinion where the Maurer decision was addressed in any way. And then looking at a prior Court of Appeals decision, State v. McCauley also went along with what Maurer court said reason to know means a substantial or in conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. I think if the issues were analyzed with that scienter element involved instead of negligence, the decision on whether this statute is constitutional is changed. Because what's important in a recklessness standard is a person disregards a known risk and they make a conscious decision to disregard.
Mr. Baker, the question I have is, what is your basis to believe that standard should apply with all First Amendment cases? And in particular, I noticed both the Supreme Court in AJB and Hensel had opportunity to look at similar language and did not identify it other than a negligent standard, whereas, of course, in the Maurer case, as you're pointing out, it was very specifically identified with regard to child pornography, which is not involved here. In other words, so what basis would that be a standard for all First Amendment cases that should be applied?
Well, I think it's within the Maurer language itself, where it asks that question about, in the First Amendment context, what does this language mean? And then they come up with a recklessness standard. And I can't answer why the Supreme Court, whether it seemingly ignored its own precedent, whether it didn't like it, or what went on, because they simply don't address it, which also means they didn't overrule it. So at least if you're going to talk about the factual similarities, Maurer is also 617 criminal act, which is involving the sexual imagery. That is more akin to the non-consensual dissemination of porn situation than a stalking, which is AJB, or disorderly conduct, which is the Hensel decision.
Thank you.
And that's why I wanted the oral argument, just to say, this is an important issue, because when the legislature passed 617-261, the language they had from the Supreme Court on what reason to know means was recklessness. And the language in 261 mirrors the language language in 247 on what's prohibited. They're very similarly written statutes. And with Maurer and McCauley saying it means recklessness, that's what the legislature was on notice for. So if that's no longer the standard and we're coming into a legislative session, I think also it's important that why recklessness doesn't apply should be articulated. I don't see where the distinction can be made, except with the type of speech.
So sometimes we have appeals closely on the heels of a prior published opinion, and there may be an opportunity for one party or the other to distinguish the facts of the case. The holding of Casillas is, it seems to me, purely a question of law. The Casillas panel of this court declared the statute facially overbroad and therefore unconstitutional. I mean, so it seems to me the statute has already been struck down in its entirety. Isn't it sort of late to consider some new arguments for why it should not be?
Well, some of this is, we're still within the state, Dakota County is within the BFR period. So that's one reason, but the Court of Appeals ultimately is an error-correcting court. And if there's a case directly on point, which was not addressed by the other decision, and that prior precedent is state Supreme Court, and you have prior Court of Appeals decisions, it should be addressed.
But wasn't...
Because that's the position I'm taking.
But wasn't part of the issue, as I understand Maurer, the Supreme Court was able to use recklessness as a way to, in a sense, announce a more narrow definition to be able to constitutionally apply the statute. In Casillas, our court identified not only the negligence reason to know standard as problematic, but also the fact that there was no intent to harm required. And it was sort of the defect in the statute was twofold. It seems to me, unless that second reason is wholly unpersuasive, that Casillas would guide our decision in this case.
Well, when I was reading Casillas, it appeared they linked the two issues a lot together. But what happens if they're not so linked? A negligence standard, which the Maurer decision did say in distinguishing recklessness from negligence is, in recklessness, the actor is aware of a risk and disregards it. A negligent actor is not aware of a risk. So in Casillas, there was some conversation with the chilling effect of a person maybe shouldn't disclose it just on the chance that of the subjective views of the prosecutor. And Westlaw uses a different section, but the quote here is, the Supreme Court concluded that the statute's inclusions of a negligence standard made it more likely to have a chilling effect. I'm not sure if you remove that argument, do the issues change? In Maurer, they seem to say that met the threshold for First Amendment. And we're saying that would be the case here. The second issue I raised, I recognize it, frankly, is more of a policy decision for the Supreme Court. Yeah. But I did want to point out that is one difference, is that I'm articulating in this appeal that non-consensual dissemination of porn should be either considered an independent basis for exclusion from protected areas of speech, or that the idea of child porn should be re-envisioned as something that means non-consensual imagery. And it's an already existing exception. And I think that's an important issue because what it seems like where the case law is going is that it's freezing in time at a time when communication is certainly not free, or more forms of communication are not freezing. Because what are the exceptions that are considered not protected? Defamation. What is that ultimately? Lies. So that has no political protection, fighting words, words that make someone upset. But we articulate that non-consensual dissemination of a sexual image is different. First of all, it's against someone's will. The doctrine that would be enshrined then is that the images of my body or me engaged in the most private of acts without my consent is free conversation for the rest of the world. And it seems like that should have more protection than whether someone says things that aren't true about me. And it certainly goes to this, and it's not just based on statutory right, it's based in a constitutional right of privacy. So in that situation, the doctrine is seemingly to say that the right to privacy must always yield to the right to free speech. And we articulate there's something wrong with that. And then finally, distinguishing. Defamation and fighting words, they can be recorded, they can be in written form, but many times they're just simply oral. A photographic image, which is not consensual form in all instances, is permanent. The victim of that has no remedy ever to correct that. That is out in the world for the world to see. And these are the kind of cases that I've seen in my job are, you know, and my fear is that it has a desperate impact on females over males. Because what I've seen is it's women or young girls who are being pressured to send this out, or they're being manipulated by saying, we will release these images if you don't comply with what we want. And that's troubling. Because there is no remedy a victim of non-consensual porn has, because the image is out there. And but I do recognize, too, that this is under an exception that is best set for the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, but need to raise it here, which is why I'm doing so. I have no other argument.
It appears there are no further questions from the panel. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Baker. The case is submitted. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That is the last oral argument on today's calendar for this panel, so the court is now adjourned.